what we need in marriage is not the idea that everything's perfect, but the clarity that we can grow, that we can be in honest conversations, that we can use who we are to better understand ourselves and better understand the other. When you have that, then the marriage has a growth mechanism. When we hide, when we lie, when we won't self-confront, but then the marriage doesn't have a way to get stronger, and therefore it's not a great place to place your heart.
Welcome to Conversations with Dr. Jennifer, a collection of interviews on the topics of relationships, sexuality, spirituality, and more, all featuring Dr. Finlayson Fife.
Hello and welcome to a new episode. I am so thrilled today to be joined by Dr. Jennifer Finlayson Fife. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Today's discussion is super important, and this is why I brought in someone very credible and needed for this conversation. We are going to be talking about pornography within our faith and from that perspective. So this is something that affects so many individuals, but it feels like such a heavy topic and very taboo in our LDS culture. And so many people suffer in silence and are weighed down by shame and fear. And that's why I want to have this discussion with you, Jennifer. Is my hope is by talking about this openly, we can better understand the impact of pornography and support those who are struggling and learn how to create homes where healing and honest conversations are possible. So I'd love to just start and hear from your perspective, why is this an important conversation for our Latter-day Saint community?
Well, in part because we have such a high standard around sexual behavior, which I think is a very valuable part of our faith. But with it comes the risk and the challenge that both the way we learn to think about our sexuality and desire and the way that we understand ourselves can actually create a deep division within ourselves, create more of a sense of shame and fear around sexuality, and actually drive us into behaviors that often work against our peace with ourselves, our peace with our sexual nature, and our ability to create intimate marriages. And pornography is a topic and experience that is so charged that it often keeps us from finding our way within it, both for men and women. And so being able to talk about it and think about it and understand it better, as well as human eroticism better, our spouse better, can help us find a better way than many of us have found yet in our lives.
Yes. And I didn't give an introduction on how you're so qualified for this conversation, but if you're not familiar with Dr. Jennifer Finlayson Fife, she has worked decades in the space in helping couples to have stronger, healthier, and more passionate relationships. And I feel like we have to talk about pornography in that setting so that people who might be struggling or not finding that peace within themselves, like, they deserve that. God wants them to have these thriving relationships and be in these good places. And sometimes when we avoid the conversation altogether, we avoid ever getting to a place where we can have that healthy relationship. So I wanted to start, because you mentioned this, I wanted to start in talking about how we frame sexuality in the church as a whole and how that creates this environment that we're talking about, this shame and this like secrecy. Can we talk about what happens when we frame sexuality that way and how, even outside of the context of pornography, and how that is harmful?
Yeah. So again, because we have a very high standard, often well-intentioned teachers and parents use fear as a motivator to keep us from having sex outside of marriage. And it's an understandable response, but when you create a fear-based relationship to the body and your sexuality, you actually drive either repression or obsession with sexuality. We have a theology that values the body, values marriage, even values sexuality, and yet we talk about it in a way that actually is contradictory to the best in our theology and interferes with us coming to peace with the body that God gave us, including its capacity for pleasure and our ability to love and be loved through our sensual and sexual selves. So when we make the only goal in raising our children about keeping them virgins until they get to the altar, we might achieve that with enough fear, but we then set them up for difficulty of actually creating an intimate marriage. And that can either be through suppressing of desire or deep anxiety about cultivating feelings of desire within oneself, and or compartmentalizing your sexuality. That is to say, because I feel shame about my sexual nature and my desires, unless my spouse can validate everything I want and everything I am sexually, I'm going to go and take it elsewhere, take it into a more private space. And pornography is a ready-made place for that. And so a lot of people viewing porn are deeply conflicted about sex and their sexuality, but they are sort of handling it through this kind of indulgence and suppression. And they're actually creating less ability to forge something honest and real with a spouse.
Yeah. In your book, you wrote, pornography is more often a symptom of one's challenges with self-regulation and intimacy than it is the cause of them.
Yes.
And I want you to just elaborate on that and help us understand some of the reasons why individuals would turn to pornography, because I think that helps us to maybe have more empathy when dealing with this.
Well, first of all, I think there is a narrative out there that porn kills love. That is the idea that porn is the thing that's because there's a strong correlation, to start with this, between porn viewing and feeling bad about yourself, porn viewing and having conflict in marriages, porn viewing and depression and anxiety. And so a lot of times we then say, it's the porn that created the trouble in the marriage. The porn created the depression and anxiety, or the feelings of low self-esteem. And it certainly may have an impact. I'm not suggesting that it doesn't. But it can also go the other way, that a person struggling with low self-esteem or self-doubt or having conflict in their marriage may also turn to a source that makes them feel more immediately better, porn being one of them. You know, it used to be when I was growing up that, you know, if you wanted to look at porn, you had to work for it a bit. You had to be willing to go into a convenience store and buy a magazine. You had to be willing to have something show up at in your mailbox. Now it's so ubiquitous that our kids are seeing porn without even looking for it, right? It's just out there. And so it's a very, you know, we have a larger cultural challenge right now that's not just about porn. It's even online social media. It's you know, it's very easy when we're anxious and unsettled to turn to the comfort of immediate gratification. You know, I know when I was even writing the book, there would be times where I just like would be struggling to figure out what I wanted to say, whatever, and I'd immediately just like pick up my phone, get on, you know, want to see Instagram or something. Like, how did I even get here? You know, and the reason is because in that discomfort, you just instinctively go for comfort, and so it's often there as a tempting place to kind of, you know, and when we feel sexual arousal, we have immediate sense of relief from. Well, what I'm trying to say is we step out of our anxieties and worries in a way. And so arousal can be a very intoxicating place to be. It can be a very wonderful place to be if it's accruing to something good in our lives. But it can also lull us when we have harder things we need to deal with for our lives to be peaceful. So a vice is anything we tend to go to whenever we really should stay the course on something more challenging. We go for the immediate comfort, and all of us do this. Porn is one way that we do it. And so the challenge with porn is that, and I'm not saying all vices are created equal or anything like that, but we vilify it so much that we actually often drive it into more secrecy and privacy and actually keep it in place. And I think more honest conversations could help us. There's some people out there that say, I'm pro-porn. I don't even actually know what that would mean. But I think the reason why that idea is out there is because I have been saying for a while that we need to stop vilifying it so much and start better understanding it so that we can stay in the driver's seat of our lives. And I think there are some people that it's been a harmful thing for them, or it's hurt their marriage or whatever. And so they see that as a threatening idea. But I think that actually, you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant, or if we can see ourselves more truthfully within our choices, we actually get more agency within them.
Well, and when we look at the society's response to pornography, it's very like it's in the church. We obviously see it as a sin, and we're very, there's a lot of shame attached to it. And I feel like that pushes people even further away from the church, because in society, it's more acceptable and sometimes seen as a necessity. And I'm not saying that we need to pivot and talk about it as a good thing in the church. Not at all. Like, of course, we'll continue to label it as harmful and what it is. But I like what you're saying. It needs to be less charged, less fear-based, so that we can just openly talk about it. Do you have any thoughts on ways that we can do that in our church community?
Well, one thing I think is really helpful, and even in talking to our children, if you have children, is to normalize desire. And to normalize the draw of sexuality and nudity, like that these are very normal human feelings. Because a lot of adolescents, young adolescents, get the idea from their parents or from church lessons that there's something broken about them, or that this is Satan getting into their hearts, the fact that they want to see a naked woman. And that's just normal. That's just a part of our normal sexual development, and the draw of Eros, like the desire to be in connection with or to see the fascination of the human body. So normalizing helps our kids to understand nothing is going wrong, and yet my choices matter. How I respond to these feelings matters. So nothing's weird about the feelings, but my choices are going to lead me in one direction or another. And what is it that I want to create? How do I want to receive the gift of my body and sexuality? How do I want to respond to these feelings? What's going to create a meaningful and good life for me? So we don't have to use shame as a motivator. We actually want the good life as the motivator. You need breaks to be able to create an intimate relationship. So developing self-control matters. But how we develop it matters, because paradoxically, the more we shame, the less self-control we tend to have. But also, why do I want to manage these sexual feelings? Because if I indulge them, it's not going to go well for me. It's not going to go well for my relationships. So you can use even your long-term interest to shape your choices, but in a way that integrates your sexual feelings and desires, that is, allows you to accept them, but also allows you to make choices you can stand by with them.
That's so good. And I appreciate, I feel like we're seeing that shift in the church. Like, it's funny, if you look at the old For Strength of Youth, like it compared like sexual sin to murder within the pamphlet. Yeah. And now it will say like your sexual desire is a sacred and important part of you. Yes, and God-given, like it's inherent. And I like that messaging is so important. So we are seeing that shift, I think.
Yes, we are.
Well, we have to perpetuate it and continue it in our homes.
Yes.
I would love to know, when you're working with couples, how do you like define pornography use? Do you talk about it as an addiction? Do you talk about it as a sin? Is it both?
I don't refer to it as either. I mean, first of all, it depends on what's actually happening. I don't usually use the language of sin per se. I mean, I think that it's more about understanding the choice and helping people better understand when they're going to a behavior that they don't feel good about, what is driving that choice, and what are the consequences for them, and, you know, what are even the upsides of those choices, because there's some reason why they're going to it, and even understanding that can be helpful. So that they can better assert choices that they can actually back up with their whole souls, not just a part of themselves. But the reason why I don't tend to use the framing of addiction is because when you frame a problem, you also have implicit to the framing what the solutions are. And the addiction model, generally speaking, has the framing that, you know, like, for example, in AA, there's this idea that alcohol has control over me, therefore I am always an addict. And I think with something like an actual substance, there's a wisdom in that approach. That is, I am not stronger than this physical substance and its effect on my mind and soul. So it's also true that you can fully live without alcohol and live a good life. And so basically saying, I am not as strong as I think I am, is a smart approach when dealing with substance abuse. But in something like say, a compulsion around pornography, a compulsion around food, a compulsion around spending money, when there's anything where moderation is what you need, the idea that the draw is stronger than you actually drives you into a weaker place. So there's an approach out there that that is LDS adjacent. It doesn't, certainly not sanctioned by the church, but where they use the idea of you have to fight like the sons of Helaman, and you have to fight off your sexual feelings because Satan and his minions are trying to get your soul through your sexual feelings. Well, I've worked with clients who've gone to therapists practicing that approach, and they actually got more obsessed with sex, more anxious about seeing a woman coming towards them on the street, because they would sort of think, this is Satan coming to tempt me. And therefore, like, actually getting more fearful, more vigilant, and less able to actually create a marriage. Like, they were almost trying to divorce themselves from their sexuality to be free. But it never worked, because we are embodied sensual beings. Just like you can't say, I'm never going to eat food again. How am I going to figure out a healthy relationship to this pleasure and relate to it in a way that accrues to my peace with myself and my health, the healthiness of my body? That's a different set of questions. And so I use the language more of compulsion when it's appropriate. If somebody feels out of control, which a lot of people do, they are in a behavior pattern. They're dealing with anxiety in a patterned way, and understanding what that pattern is, shedding light on it, helping them to see where they're making choices and why, actually helps them to find their agency within it. So I think a lot of times people use the language of addiction because they do feel out of control. They have part of their mind that's saying, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. Mm-hmm. I hate this in me. And yet I'm still doing it. And so they're trying to make sense of that deep divide within themselves. But sometimes people then say, sexuality is stronger than I am. And I don't think it's the right understanding, because it actually makes them have even less hope, even more self-hatred, and less ability to make a different choice.
Yeah, that's so important. And also, like, aligns with our understanding that, like, we are to be acted, not to be acted upon. Can you give some advice for people right now who are listening and they want to start healing and overcoming pornography, this compulsion in their life? Like, what are some of those practical advice you give?
The one thing I would say that's, I think, a little bit counterintuitive to people is to look at the part of them that does want to look at porn. Because sometimes we are so anxious about the fact that we are doing something we don't feel good about, that we just keep asserting, like, stop this, tomorrow I'm not going to do it, and kind of directing more self-hatred towards ourselves for the choices we can't feel good about. But I think where it can help us find a little more latitude internally is to look at, okay, I don't like this. I don't feel good about it for these reasons, but why do I not want to give it up? And some people will say, no, I definitely want to give it up. You don't understand. And I'm like, well, but behaviorally speaking, some part of you doesn't want to give it up. Talk to me about that part. What part of you is afraid to actually say no to it? What has it given you that you want? Now, I'm not saying that that means it's such a great thing and therefore you should stick with it, but it's a sense of freedom. For example, I had a client who had a lot of compulsivity around food. She'd grown up in a family where her parents shamed her weight and her desire for food. And they like sent her to a camp for her to lose weight against her will. You know, there was just so much control around her body and food that, of course, she was like, even as an adult, I will eat things I don't even want to prove that no one can control me. And wow, yeah. It makes good sense, right? Like, and so if you can start mm-hmm. to understand, I'm trying to reassure myself that I'm not controlled. And around sexuality, especially when there's been a lot of shame or when you have a spouse that's not interested in an intimate marriage, I don't mean to imply that's the reason someone goes to porn, because a lot of times people have very willing spouses and yet they still turn to porn. But there can be a lot of reasons why I don't want to give up the sense of agency or freedom that I have in sneaking something. And so understanding that when we are always in this compliance mindset, we will then go to defiance sometimes to assert our agency. And so we're always either complying with the rules or breaking them to feel like we are ourselves rather than self-determining, rather than saying, who do I desire to be? And so I think the first step is looking at the part of us that does want to look at it and what motivates us and what is it trying to answer for us? And how do we want to deal with that? Because what is it costing us, that form of agency, that form of freedom? And am I okay with the cost? And I mean these as really real questions. I don't mean get to the right answer questions. I mean, you are going to determine your life. You are going to determine your choices and you are going to live in the consequences of them. And so helping people get more honest with themselves, looking more at the complexity of being in relationships that disappoint, and how do we handle our disappointments? And are we handling disappointments in a way that accrue to our peace with ourselves and make us feel unapologetic about who we are? I think those are the things that we do have control over, and helping people make those choices in a way that's honest with themselves helps them actually be stronger and helps them be more capable of intimacy in their lives because they have less to hide, less to apologize for.
What do they have to gain for overcoming this compulsion? You know, like what are some motivators for them if they can overcome it?
Well, I think one is just feeling less run around by your feelings. You know, it's actually a muscle to handle more anxiety in life. And the more we can handle anxiety, the stronger we get. So that is to say, like, attention is a muscle, or dealing with difficult things is a muscle. And the more that we can deal with difficult things without running for comfort or deception or hiding who we are, the stronger we get. Not only we have more ability to affect the world and to do things that need to be done for our own benefit and for the benefit of those we love, so we build more trust in ourselves, we also build more peace in ourselves. We have less anxiety. We have less we're trying to get away from. Developing our capacity is a big deal. Developing self-trust is a big deal because you're less needy. You need less reassurance from your partner. Mm-hmm. You love them and you love being loved by them, but you don't need them to tell you you're okay or that your sexuality is okay. You also become somebody that people naturally trust more, and you get more honest validation, right? Like sometimes we're hiding things because we want cheap validation. We want people to think things about us that aren't in fact true because we want their approval, but we always have this sense that we're hiding, we're living in a duplicity. And when we are more deeply aligned within ourselves, people see that and they trust us more and they love you more. They say more positive things and it has a landing place because it's true and it's real. Now, again, I would really assert that you still may decide that you don't want to do that or that you want to have pornography in your life. Everybody gets to decide, but we owe it to ourselves to know that that's not a choice based in our lesser selves, that it's not a choice based in our anger towards others. You know, are we giving our power away and then really in our core not feeling at peace? Or are we truly living in alignment with our honest selves? That's what I really think is valuable for people to create, because they always create more peace and more strength when they do that.
Yeah. Amen. I would love to talk now about how to respond and also like interacting with it within our marriages, partnerships, families. What are some of the healthy ways that loved ones can respond if they discover someone close to them is struggling with pornography? Because I feel like that is quite a big issue.
Yeah. Well, it depends, of course, if it's a child, if it's a partner. And it really depends on how they're responding themselves to it. You know,
Maybe could we talk about both, as far as like talk about it from a child perspective and parent relationship, and then talk about it from a husband and wife relationship?
Yeah, it's tricky because there's so many different variables, but let me just try and give you like a typical scenario. If you have a child, you know, it can scare us as parents, and we can get overly reactive because we're afraid, are they going to develop a real habit? Are they going to, you know, undermine their sexuality? Is this going to go on in a way that will undermine their ability to be in a marriage? So it's an understandable fear, because we're also in an environment, again, where it's everywhere and there is just so much that is sketch out there. And our kids have access to this portal into, you know, craziness, really. And so it's an understandable fear. But again, I think the more that we can not just vilify and scare our kids more, you know, with the parent's reaction or with the therapist's reaction, depending on who the therapist is and what their modality is, but more understanding it as, again, normal to seek it out, normal to handle our anxieties through this secret entrance into a world that can feel like a relief in a way from the pressures your adolescent may be feeling, but also understanding that it does have some cost to them, that how is this habit going to accrue to their well-being? So yes, it's understandable to go to this thing, but I would be looking at what's going on in my child's life that they are turning to it. First of all, is it just once in a while, a curiosity? Or is there something compulsive going on where they're really not dealing with their lives and they really are struggling in some place, and this is a symptom of it? So it's just trying to get a better read on what is happening and hopefully being able to have some honest conversations with your child about it. And, you know, it can be hard to listen. You know, I had a child who was going to video games somewhat compulsively, not dealing with their schoolwork, dealing with their sense of inadequacy in this way, because they were really good at the video games and they just liked the, you know, the kind of social connection that it had, but it was a very limited kind of social connection. And so just understanding it, you know, takes some forbearance, because it's like, yeah, but that's just not a good choice. And that, you know, you want to kind of get in there and change their mind, but actually just trying to understand it and helping them think about what it's costing them is the way to help them develop more resolve, more desire to choose differently. You trying to micromanage everything is not what they need. They've got to get clarity that they want to create a new pattern in their life, because you're not going to control that ultimately. Now, I don't mean to say that you can't create realities in your home that make it difficult to access, of course. And I think the more we have legislation that interferes with social media's access to our children or our children's ability to access these things, the healthier our kids are going to be, because these have proved to be very bad for our kids' mental health. But I think that in the meantime, helping your children develop more self-awareness and thinking about the consequences of their choices is the best way to help them get on board with their own.
That's so good. I know that there's so many varying experiences with it. Obviously every situation is different. And as a parent, like, you have the spirit to help you in those situations. But I feel like that was very concrete and good.
Yeah. Good. Good. So with a spouse, again, it's challenging because, you know, first of all, if men find out their wives are looking at porn, which is not very typical, but if they do, they don't feel particularly challenged by it. They're more like, oh, well, why didn't you tell me? Or like, you know, it's not as threatening. It's much more threatening for women to find out that their husbands have been looking at it. And I think there's a few reasons for this, but one of the reasons is that I think for women, the turn on in sex is often to be the turn on. It's that I have caught your attention. You find me beautiful. You find me desirable. You want to be with me. And especially because we have this stereotype that men's sexuality is indiscriminate. And does my spouse want to just have sex or do they want to have sex with me, right? That's an important question in women's psychology and sexuality. Mm-hmm. And so to find out, oh, he's actually looking at other women. Okay, well, then what does that mean about me? Like, then I'm not enough for him. And he's comparing me to other people. That's often the instinctive and understandable response. Whether or not it's actually the right response is another question. Whether or not it's the right understanding is what I'm trying to say. But it's an understandable feeling of like, wait a minute, is this about us or not? What is this? Mm-hmm. So it can feel deflating and it can also feel like an affirmation that you just want sexual feelings. You don't necessarily want something that's about the two of us. And I think that can undermine the sense that we've cultivated something sacred and just about you and me. Hmm. At the same time, while that's very challenging, it's important to not just go into a angry and shaming response. If you can, I mean, maybe at first you will, but I think it's like ultimately, well, please tell me about it. Why do you look at it? Is it about me not being enough? Is it about dissatisfaction? And what is dissatisfying for you if that is part of it? Now, I don't mean to say like, oh, it's the woman's, you know, limited sexual repertoire that's driving him to porn. I do not mean that at all. But I mean using the opportunity to better understand each other, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of husbands would say, it's not about you at all. I find you very attractive. This is not about that. I'm not thinking about any of those women. I mean, and I think that's true for most men. It's more that this is just like a place to go. It's a place of relief. It's like a way of just feeling sexual feelings and sort of escaping some of the anxiety and the pressures I feel. It is for some clients I've worked with a feeling of like if they're in a marriage that's rather dead or their spouse is like anxious about sexuality and doesn't want to deal with their sexual relationship, then it can be like an act of some anger that the husband is saying, oh, I'm justified in lying to her. I'm justified in hiding this because she doesn't even want to have a sexual relationship with me. So again, there's a lot of important self-deceptions and self-justifications that a couple can utilize to get stronger in these kinds of crises. Very commonly, people just go to, you have an addiction, go to this program, you're broken, when you're all fixed, I'm willing to think about having sex with you again, okay? But it's a it's too simple-minded of a response. So I'm not suggesting that the woman is the problem. At the same time, using it to understand each other and to understand, okay, well, the woman might say, yeah, I am reluctant around sex because I don't feel particularly loved by you. I feel like you just have sexual needs and it doesn't feel that great to be there. And again, I'm not saying that anybody is singularly right in their response, but if a couple can get more truth on the table, they might be able to sort out a place that's more honest, more invested in each other, more invested in their higher selves and forging a better relationship. In my book, I bring up multiple stories and one couple that has a pornography issue that handles it more through kind of self-justification and another couple that then uses it to self-confront both of them to understand their part in an intimate relationship that's been struggling and to cultivate something stronger and better together. That really is a reflection of both of them. That feels like a good place to be for two of them. But this is a process that pushes us to grow up. And so nothing's going wrong. That's the one thing I would say is that it takes some time to figure out how to be an embodied sexual being. It takes some practice to figure out how to make sense of this part of ourselves and to learn to love and be loved with it. And we don't need to vilify or shame ourselves for struggling to navigate embodiment. It's a process. It's a spiritual process.
Well, and how hard is it to embody it when we don't talk about it? And it's such a taboo topic 100%. In our faith, like sexuality in general. And so maybe give each other some grace. But that's why communication really is so key. And I one thing that I did love about your book and that story specifically is I hope it just gives people this hope and perspective that like not all is lost if this is something that you're working through or dealing with in your marriage, that like you actually can come back stronger. This just shows like there's more learning and communication that needs to be had, and skills need to be developed.
Exactly. And you know, and one of the theses of my book is that, you know, the title of it is that we might have joy. And joy is really a capacity. We grow in our ability for it, and we grow through our deepening ability to love and be loved, to be at peace in our own skin, to be in an intimate marriage, to be able to enjoy one another more deeply. That is a spiritual process in and of itself, and joy is the evidence of that development, right? So yes, we can feel discouraged or this is hard, but this is part of the process. And when we shame our sexuality and or shame ourselves for not being clear about this, we don't get anywhere. St. Bradley of Nyssa says, sin is what happens when we refuse to keep growing. That's what I think of most as sin. It's not making mistakes. We all make mistakes, but it's about being willing to see ourselves and learn from them and to keep, you know, learn about what is our impact on another and how do we want to choose in a way that's stronger or better? That's the process that we're about on this earth life.
Yeah, I love that, that distinction of mistakes and sins. I had a listener submit this question to me. I have a couple of submissions that I just wanted to get your perspective on.
Sure.
She said, my husband recently told me that he has a porn addiction. I'm feeling very complex emotions about how to be intimate with him going forward. Sometimes it feels like I'm desperate for affection and closeness in an effort to feel normal, and other times being intimate feels far too vulnerable to even think about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so first of all, I think, you know, sex is very often a place of wanting to feel reassured and that we're a couple and that it's you and me. And, you know, I talk about it in the book as being like the sacrament of a marriage because it's this place to kind of find each other, to feel a sense of reassurance. So that desire she has certainly makes sense. And she's in this conflicted emotion of, I want to be close to you and I want to get away from you. And they're both understandable ideas because I want to be reassured, but I'm mad and I feel insecure. And I think talking openly about that with your spouse, like I both want to be close to you. I want to feel loved by you. I want to feel that I am your person. And yet I feel like I'm taking a chance if I do that because you've been willing to hide this or you've been willing to look at other women and I feel threatened by that. And it doesn't mean that, okay, and he's going to come back with the answer. I don't necessarily mean that, but you're at least creating more intimacy, even through talking about, I'm ambivalent. Like, I love you and hate you right now, both. Like, I desire you and want to get away from you, both. And I think it can also allow the husband in that situation to better understand that my choices have real impact. And do I want to deal with my impact? And if so, how? The goal is not to guilt the husband or to get him to give reassurance even. It's about bringing the kind of honesty of each other into the conversation because it's in that tension that new growth emerges. You know, I even talk about this a lot in the book that it's often in the contraries and the contradictions and the places we feel divided from our spouse that new growth happens because I'm at least in an honest conversation with you. We feel miles apart, but we're trying to build a bridge. And then you actually become more able to build an honest bridge. And it's a creative process. And it's not about denying something in yourself. It's actually reaching for what's honest and creating something solid and real between you. That's when you really become a couple. And so it's, again, it's imperfect. It can feel lonely. It can feel uncertain. And she, I feel for her because she and they are in that space. But it is a space where something new can grow when you bring your courage and your honesty to it.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I have this other question, and I feel like it's good for my younger listeners because people, mm-hmm. those in the dating scene, she says, I'm in a sure. serious dating relationship with someone who I care about deeply, and they've admitted to struggling with pornography. They've been honest with me about viewing it at least 3 occasions when I have asked, and I'm really trying to process what this means for our future and how to move forward in a way that honors both my emotions and spiritual well-being. I've been praying mm-hmm. a lot, but I still feel very isolated.
Well, and probably isolated because, again, we struggle to be in honest conversation about it and really understanding how typical it is.
Yeah, she probably feels alone in this environment,
exactly.
but she's not.
Right. She's not, exactly. And so, again, I would just be at the place of knowing him better. If you are feeling like you are trying to extract information from him, that's not a great sign. I don't know what's going on in this particular couple, but is it something he offered honestly on his own? Was it offered only when he was asked? Is he saying it's only happened 3 times, period? Is that what she was saying? That might be true, but that doesn't sound like somebody who would think of themselves as struggling with a problem. So the reason I'm saying all that is the foundation a couple needs is not anyone being perfect. What it does need is an honest foundation. One in which you are willing to be known and willing to know the other. Mm-hmm. And the places where couples struggle the most is when there has been deception and ongoing deception. Like, I'm going to steal your choices by hiding from you who I really am. That way you will love me, have sex with me, marry me, whatever the thing is, because you don't fully know me. And so, of course, if somebody finds out more later, they feel deeply betrayed because you willingly and purposefully took information from me that I needed to make a choice I can live with. What we often need in marriage is not the idea that everything's perfect, but the clarity that we can grow, that we can be in honest conversations, that we can use who we are to better understand ourselves and better understand the other. When you have that, then the marriage has a growth mechanism. When we hide, when we lie, when we won't self-confront, then the marriage doesn't have a way to get stronger, and therefore it's not a great place to place your heart.
What advice would you give, though, in like discerning the issue and knowing if it's serious enough to like end a relationship yeah. or move forward? Is it just that honesty, if you're willing to be open about it, or are there other things to be aware of?
Yeah. I would be asked if I were dating somebody and that was what they said, I would say, can you just tell me more about it? When did you first look at it? How much do you look at it? How do you feel about it? What impact do you think it has on you? Have you made efforts to not look at it? Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't feel good about it, why don't you feel good about it? If you don't feel good about it, why do you think you still look at it sometimes? Not because you're there to police them, but you're there to know them. And, you know, when somebody is in a relationship with their own limitations, but they're in an honest relationship with themselves, it shows. It shows because they have something to say about it. They're like, yes, you know, this is how I've understood it. This is what I've done. This is why I look at it less now. Oh, if that's true, this is what I've tried, but it didn't work. And I still look at it regularly, you know, but it's now that might be a difficult conversation to have because they may be afraid if I give my honest answer, she's not going to want to be with me, but you owe it to yourself. I think I was probably not a very fun person to date because I was studying to be a marriage therapist, but I was like, I want to know this person.
Yeah.
I went on like a second date with somebody and he was a bit older. And I just said like, how do you make sense of the fact that you aren't yet married? And it wasn't because I was like, what's your problem? I was myself like 26 at the time. So it wasn't like I was critiquing him. I was just wanting to better understand, like, did he have self-awareness? Did he have self-understanding? And I remember he took that as a very like a threatening question. And I wasn't in any judgment, actually. I had thoughts about why I wasn't yet married. I was looking for self-awareness and an ability to be in a conversation that was real. And he just wasn't willing or able, I'm not sure, to provide it, which is fine. Of course, he gets to have his privacy, of course. But it was that, for me, that was important because it signaled something about what kind of a person he was, how willing he was to reveal himself and be in an honest self-awareness with me, which to me felt pretty important, because I don't mean that I wouldn't marry someone without limitations, but I'd want them to know what they are and to be able to be honest about them and in an honest conversation around them, just as I would expect of myself.
I have seen women, especially, I'm sure men feel this too, with their partners dealing with pornography, but they almost feel like they do have to be the police, that they, like, if I can control and keep track of the times it's used, then I can get rid of the issue. Yeah. I would love to hear, like, advice you have so that women don't take on that burden or carry it when it is something that is happening in their relationship. And for men, either.
Yeah, it's good. First of all, it's a totally understandable impulse. And yet, it's 100% not going to give you what you want. Because the idea is, if I have to police you because you won't police yourself, first of all, that means I do not trust you. I do not. Mm-hmm. I am not with someone that I believe is trustworthy, and therefore I have to make them love me. You know, that's the idea. I have to make them control themselves. Well, that's not someone who controls themselves. That's you controlling someone. And so you won't trust them. But it also gives them the ability to basically resent you and your micromanagement and your control rather than dealing with themselves.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if they feel like, oh, my spouse is my police, I don't have to actually look at my own choices and make my own decisions around it and figure out what I actually am willing to do. It's also true that it's not the pornography per se that is the problem. So what I mean is, let's say you succeed and you keep them from ever looking at it. Or let's say the whole internet shuts down for a couple of months. They aren't going to turn into a more loving husband. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, because the morality of learning how to discern who you are, to determine who you want to be, if you're going to choose your spouse and bring your best there, to bring your honesty there, to bring your sexuality there, meaning that's all soul development stuff that nobody controls but the partner themselves. And so it's totally legit for a spouse to want to understand her husband and to know who he is and what choices he is making. But that's a different idea than thinking you are in charge of it or that you are going to single-handedly police it. And mm-hmm. It's really important to stay clear about that. It's the difference between knowing your spouse and taking on the responsibility of keeping their thoughts clean, you know, quote unquote. That's never going to work out.
Mm-hmm. What advice do you have for those who have been dealing with this for a long time and have tried to work through it but feel like they're just keep falling into the rhythm of it? Any hope, like, that you would share?
There is hope, because it depends a lot on how you've been approaching it. If you've been in the addiction model, a lot of people don't realize that the framing is often, and not every treatment approach out there is the same. So I'm speaking in a very broad way. But if you're sort of seeing this as something that kind of comes and gets you, or something you got to stay away from, in this kind of just like the only right answer is that you will never, ever look at that again. Usually that's more of a white knuckling approach that tends to fail. That's just my experience of working with people, is it tends to fail. Mm-hmm. And so what it ends up doing is it discourages people. It makes them feel like this thing just continues to have control over their souls. And so they lose hope and they hate themselves a little more and their spouse hates them a little more. And they just never are able to find something more solid in themselves. The truth is, though, something solid in them does exist. They just have to find it and figure out why they keep preferencing the more indulgent part of themselves over the stronger part. And there's a reason for it. There's things to be understood about it. My work focuses a lot on helping people move out of an external authority to a deeper internal authority. Because as we move from this externalized, what do you want me to be? What do you think I should be? To the question of, who do I think I should be? That's where we find our strength. That's where we increase our capacity. That's where we increase our agency. And that's what moral development is. That's what spiritual development is. And so it's very tempting to keep the external paradigm going. Your spouse is going to regulate your choices. You're going to let them regulate you while you resent them at the same time. But you're going to always stay stuck as long as you're there. So any therapy or approach that helps you move into a deeper self-knowledge and deeper honesty around your choices is going to help you get to a place where you can honestly stand. Acceptance and commitment therapy does this very well. Cameron Staley does work in the acceptance and commitment therapy model and has addressed through some of his courses and so on, an approach to addressing unwanted pornography use this way. But any therapist that uses that approach can be very helpful for helping you get into deeper self-awareness and making choices that you can back up with your own soul. And that's essential. If you've never taken that approach, there's a lot there for you if mm-hmm. you can find somebody to help facilitate that in you.
Amazing. Before we end, is there anything that we didn't touch on in this conversation that my questions didn't bring up that you would like to add to this discussion through your research and all that you've done?
Well, maybe I would just add, you know, I wrote my dissertation on LDS women and sexual agency and what is women's relationship to sex. And so that was my initial primary focus when I first started doing this work. And then, of course, I started working with more couples and then started doing more work with men. So I have an online course for men, The Art of Loving. Well, in the process of developing that course and seeing men's comments in the online group and so on, it's really helped me better understand how many men internalized a lot of messaging around their sexuality, that it was shameful, that it was toxic, that it was a way to harm a woman or make her less pure. And so even though men tend to be the higher desire people around sex because of how men are wired, they have often just as much anxiety and fear and self-rejection around sexuality that is often a part of the story of how porn becomes a secret place to kind of experience these feelings without it being something that you reveal to yourself even or into a relationship. And so it's easy to come in with more judgment rather than more understanding of what it been like to be a man or a young man growing up with these messages. How did they relate to this part of themselves? How did they relate to porn when they saw it? How, you know, because there's usually an understandable story there. And again, it's not then, oh, okay, nothing matters. Or you can just do whatever you want because I feel sorry for you. It's not that. But how can I understand how you became who you are? And how do we build a bridge across our different experiences? And how do we know each other and love each other and accept each other more and create something better for both of us here? That's the goal.
Love that. So good. And I haven't really thought about that perspective until I was reading your book. And so I appreciate that. I've done a couple episodes on our theology on sex and just helping, I would say, women for the most part to understand and to tap into it. But thinking about how our culture has also impacted men is really important in giving us grace and understanding why we're the way we are sometimes.
Yes, so, exactly.
It's so good. Well, okay, talk about your book for a second and also share other resources where people can find you and what you have to offer. Because I know this was a very broad conversation, very general, but you can find what you need through other resources that you have. So please share those.
Great. Well, the book is called That We Might Have Joy, Desire, Divinity, and Intimate Love is the subtitle. You can purchase it on Amazon. You can also go to my website, which is my last name, finlayson-fife.com. And there you can find online courses. I have 6 online courses and then some mini courses as well, including one for anybody that's newlywed or about to get married, a short 1-hour course on how to prepare, how to navigate that early part of a relationship. And then I also have a podcast called Room for Two, where I'm working with couples who have pseudonyms and distorted voices, but I'm doing the work of helping them navigate things like pornography issues and how to deal with the division that happens in the couple and those kinds of things. So there's excellent resources there just by actually hearing other couples' experience.
Yeah, so, so good. I wanted to tell you, because this is kind of funny, but if you go to your website, the picture of the couple is me and my husband.
Are you kidding me? That is amazing. Which course is it?
That's the strengthening your relationship.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great. So I must have bought them from your photographer. Is that
what you did. I've had some friends send it to me and they're like, it's just so funny that our engagement session.
Yeah, exactly. You guys captured happiness.
So if you need more, if you need an updated one with children, let me know.
So funny.
Well, thank you so much. I think this was so good and you're incredible. I love the work you're doing, and especially for our LDS community. So I really appreciate you.
Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, we ask that you please rate, review, and share the podcast so that more people can find and benefit from Dr. Jennifer's work.